Welcome to Local Talk on KJY Community Radio, the heart of Iowa, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm Kay Puttock, one of your hosts today, together with my co-host, Pat Schlabel. Hello, Pat.
Good morning, Kay.
And Pat's brought a guest with him who'll tell us about one of today's stories, about the hazards facing eagles.
Yes, and we'll get to the eagle story in a few minutes, but before then, here's a quick outline of the rest of today's program. Kay, I believe you've been doing some research and interviewing about rabies vaccines for dogs.
Yes, there's apparently an anti-vaccination movement around pet vaccines, just as there is with human vaccines. We'll be hearing parts of three recorded interviews on this subject. And then we'll be hearing from Roman Lynch about Midnight Madness, an event occurring tomorrow, Saturday. And our final guests will be Mary Rankin, Director of Sustainability for Iowa State University, and Kathy Welnick, Director of Transportation Services at Iowa State. Mary and Kathy will be talking about how sustainability concerns affect all the transportation matters at Iowa State. But now let's hear from you, Pat and Duane, about the eagles.
Yes, joining us this morning is Duane Schrunk from the Iowa State University Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. And Duane is here to discuss a case that began developing about the 1st of June. You work at the diagnostic lab. We had a situation where there was an eagle in the Decora North nest. Now, this is separate from the fisheries.
The famous cap.
Yeah, the famous ones. This is a backup nest, but it does have a camera. The female was noted to be somewhat impaired, and a young eaglet was kind of suffering and died. So they went in and retrieved that bird, and I met them to bring that a carcass to Iowa State University, and that's kind of where this story evolves into the diagnosis of what could possibly have afflicted this bird. Understand it was about 6 weeks old and weighed up to 5 pounds. And can you pick up our story there? What is the process of a necropsy, which is a term for wildlife as opposed to the autopsy in humans? But if you could walk us through what takes place when something like this occurs in nature.
Sure. Thanks for having me this morning.
Yeah.
When we get the animal in, the eaglet in this case also they were able to see some of the videos from that camera, and so they were able to observe some of the signs that both the adult and the eaglet were going through after they'd been exposed to this potential toxin. And so those signs, those CNS signs, central nervous system was affected. You know, they were kind of wobbling around and weren't very steady. Mm-hmm. So they can the veterinarians that I work with can make some diagnosis based on the signs they're seeing. Certain compounds will cause that to happen. One of the classic diagnoses for that might be some sort of pesticide exposure. So there's some pesticides, organophosphorus pesticides and carbamate pesticides, that can cause those signs.
Mm-hmm.
When the eaglet got there, the veterinarians did a necropsy like you talked about, and they mm-hmm. can look for any kind of gross abnormalities.
Oh, lesions.
Lesions.
On
the
organs and things like that.
Something obvious. Something obvious.
Yeah.
In this case, because of what we saw in the videos, it was pretty clear we wanted to look for, try to rule out things like, again, the pesticides or maybe something like a heavy metal, lead.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the first things we did after the necropsy, and during the necropsy is when they can also collect tissues. So if we wanted to look at the brain, the liver, the kidney, whatever organ might be affected, those tissues are pulled and saved.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing we do in a situation like this is we're going to look at that brain and look for activity of an enzyme. The enzyme is acetylcholinesterase, and it's a neurotransmitter enzyme. So because these pesticides block that enzyme, that's why you see those central nervous system signs.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that test, and if that's inhibited, it's a pretty good indication this animal was exposed to an OP, organophosphorus, or a carbamate pesticide. And in this case, that test was inhibited.
It was inhibited, yeah. So you're going to go down the path of looking for a potential toxin in the environment.
Correct. So for this case and in most cases in general, what we're going to look for is that pesticide, and there's a wide number of pesticides. I don't know the exact number, but, you know, hundreds of potential pesticides that fit these two classes. So we're going to perform some analysis. In this case, it was a crop content, but, you know, if it had been another animal, maybe a stomach content or a rumen content. We have an instrument that can look for hundreds of thousands of compounds at one time. It's very broad capabilities. Mm-hmm. So we perform an extraction on that crop content, and we look for anything that hits, really, that could be toxic. But then we're really gearing it a little more towards these specific pesticides in this case.
Mm-hmm. And some of those initial analysis, I recall there was caffeine.
Right.
That popped up.
Correct. We didn't. The first time we screened through this crop content, we didn't see any OPs or carbamates, but we did hit on caffeine, which was obviously unusual for a bird to have caffeine, but it started us thinking, you know, what could have caused that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's potential for a lot of sources of caffeine, even something as simple as a compost pile where maybe you dump your...
Coffee grounds. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And maybe, you know, the thought pattern was that some animal got into something and then the eagle picked
brought
up that,
the young
that animal brought it to the young.
Mm-hmm.
So we were trying to just figure out what that exposure could have been.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's a product on the market that is being misapplied. It's called a methyl mol. And there's an agent that what they like to do is mix this, and it's a fly a repellent, or it kills flies.
Correct.
It kills a lot of things.
It does.
And when you mix it with Coca-Cola or Pepsi or something that has caffeine with it, then people are placing this in the interest of killing raccoons primarily,
so they
or predators.
They put the cola there to attract the animal? Is that...
Well, they mix it, yeah, it that sweetness, the
right,
sucrose,
okay.
And it makes it quite appealing to these mammalian.
And that's where the caffeine comes from.
That's where the caffeine came from. So is my understanding then, that was the first precursor or some, you know, that was the first indication, what's going on here? Why would there be caffeine in an eaglet? And
exactly. We were, you know, why was the caffeine in the crop content? What was the exposure? The veterinarians more, the toxicologist at the lab was talking with several people, including maybe yourself, Pat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it came up anecdotally, if you will, that this does happen, that people will mix this fly bait with something like Coca-Cola or a sweet soda in effort to kill mainly raccoons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're getting into something they don't want them into. And I think that's, you know, something to talk about, I guess, is that this product is labeled for use for fly bait. But, you know, the realization that these compounds are toxic to more than just what they're labeled for.
Yeah, and it says right on this label of this product that I was able to pick up at the tractor supply store, it is illegal to use this product with the intention to kill raccoons, skunks, opossums, coyotes, wolves, dogs, cats, or any other non-target species. The problem is it's got the red slash through the raccoon. If you're in there thinking you've got sweet corn to protect and you're going to try to inhibit the raccoons, you see that, and, well, maybe this will work. Well, it does work. And the problem is in nature when you put a poison out there that is targeting one species, in nature, you don't do just one thing. It goes down the road of, my gosh, well, we took care of the raccoons, but now it's affecting our national symbol. So there is there's an awareness that we appreciate your opportunity to share this information with us, Mr. Schrunk, because this is a story that now has impacted a pretty high-profile pair of bald eagles in Decorah, the second nesting pair, Decorah North. And I hope people realize that when you put poison in the environment, you're going to probably have some indirect negative consequences of those actions.
Yeah, I think it's something, like you said, it's important to talk about. You know, there's historical data with DDT that you talked about and how that can affect other things other than the target animal. There's plenty of examples out there of times when the target is not what is affected. Some of the rat poisonings that are on the market are slowly being taken off because they do have secondary effects, things of that nature. So it's important to just realize that, you know, you should use the pesticides as labeled. They're labeled that way for a reason.
Well, thank you for all your good work at the diagnostic lab at the Iowa State University Veterinary Clinic. Thank you for kind of sharing this story. Hopefully we can maybe eliminate some of these poisons that are indirectly affecting bald eagles and other
wildlife.
Yes,
thank you very much.
You're welcome. Yeah. Thank you.
That brings up another issue of following instructions, I guess. And it's another issue facing wildlife and an issue that people at Iowa State help me with, too. This is an issue facing wildlife and domestic animals, rabies I'm talking about. And I learned from this next series of interviews that the problem of rabies also affects many more humans than I realized. I started researching the topic of rabies vaccines after KHOI received a request for an interview from a Dr. Keller, who's a retired physician and ophthalmologist who lives in Roland. Dr. Keller has a number of Samoyed dogs that he keeps for sledding in the winter. He wanted to bring up a concern he has about the administration of booster vaccines for his dogs. I've just arrived at Dr. Keller's place out south of Roland. He's walking one of his dogs here. And you can maybe hear the other dogs barking in the background. Dr. Keller, why don't you tell me the trouble you've been having about the vaccinations, your dog's rabies vaccines?
Well, at first I didn't think there was a problem. I was getting notices from my veterinarian to come back and bring the dog in for revaccination about a year after the previous vaccination. But then after doing this a few times, I remembered reading a long time ago or hearing a long time ago that the booster vaccination was supposed to be good for 3 years. So I asked the veterinarian about that, and he said that there was a law that he said I shouldn't blame him for, which was that if the booster is even one day late, then it's only good for a year. So this didn't seem right to me because vaccinations are potent medications, and like other potent medications, there's a right amount to give. For example, if your mother were getting chemotherapy, you wouldn't want to hear the doctor saying that the mother has to get another extra dose this afternoon just because the nurse gave her the noon dose 10 minutes late. So I decided to check around and see what other states were doing. I called the veterinary board in Minnesota and talked to Dr. Wilson there, and she told me that in Minnesota, the booster, now this is all the shots after the first, the booster rabies shot is good for 3 years, whether it's late or not. And she told me that's the CDC recommendation. The CDC is the Center for Disease Control. It's a federal bureau which is empowered by the U.S. Constitution to promote the general welfare by studying disease issues and making recommendations, which the states might or might not follow. Most of them do follow. I also called the veterinary board in New York and talked to an administrative assistant there named Kevin, who told me about the same thing that Dr. Wilson had told me in Minnesota. So then I started contacting local Iowa officials, and I was referred from one to another, eventually ended up talking to the ombudsman, and the ombudsman wanted me to call the veterinary board myself and find out about it, but I thought that it was the ombudsman's job to do this, that they should make a contribution by calling the veterinary board, which by this time I had come to suspect was the source of this possible illegality or bureaucratic overreach. But the ombudsman declined to contact the veterinary board, said it was my job to do that. So I've pretty much written off the idea of getting any help from the ombudsman. But we'll see if maybe some of the other political leaders in the state don't do something about it. By talking to journalists, talking to members of the public, talking to veterinarians, talking to various public officials, I think I'm spreading the word about this enough that maybe Governor Branstad will decide to get the Iowa Attorney General to make a formal opinion on this matter. what is Iowa law? This is called an attorney general's opinion, and it's a routine method for settling questions like this. For example, if someone says a tax is not being collected in a lawful way, the attorney general will review the law and issue an opinion on the subject, whether the tax is lawful or not. And there's no reason the attorney general couldn't look and see what the law really is.
Now, you've written to Governor Branstad and who else?
Well, I've written to so many people in the many days now that I've been working on this. I can't remember them all. And I actually haven't written to Governor Branstad yet, but I've written the letter and I haven't mailed it.
Oh, I see.
I've written the letter. It's dated today, and it'll probably be postmarked tomorrow.
Okay.
Unless I get really busy.
Okay.
I think that would be an appropriate way to deal with it. And then if the Attorney General finds that I'm mistaken and that it really is the law, then perhaps the law could be changed to make Iowa's law conform better to the CDC and to other states. I looked in the statutes. The statutes referred me to the administrative code. I looked at the relevant sections of the administrative code to which the statutes refer. They didn't say either how long the booster should be good for, but they do refer to an article that's published by a national veterinary organization. So I looked at that article, which is supposed to be the final word in Iowa about what to do. And the article said that the boosters should be good for 3 years. And the article addressed this issue of what about the late booster? And the article said that there was a lack of evidence to support this idea that a late booster should be good for only 1 or 2 years. So the article, which supposedly, by reference, is our state law, is, to my reading, saying the opposite of what the veterinarians think the law is.
Yeah.
So that's a situation that really needs to be straightened out, and I think it's something that the governor and the attorney general could do.
Well, this is a beautiful-looking dog here, Samoyed. Could I see your other dogs?
Sure, let's go.
You have a lot of dogs here. You've got 8 dogs altogether.
Well, really, I only have 7. One of them is just boarding with me for the summer while his owners are overseas. And the reason I have 7 dogs is that Admiral Byrd said that's the ideal number for a sled team. Actually, Admiral Byrd said you should have 6 dogs pulling the sled and then a 7th for a spare, so that's how many I have. Unfortunately, even though I've been dog sledding for 2 years now, my skill level is not quite up to having 6 dogs on the sled. I've never been dog sledding with more than 2 on the sled, but I'm hoping to get up to 6 dogs one of these winters.
Okay, thank you. After I spoke with Dr. Keller, I began to research this topic, and I also spoke to a number of veterinarians about it. And there's apparently an anti-vaccination movement swirling around animal vaccines, just as there is around human vaccines. But I think this next interview sets the issues out very clearly. As far as I can make out, 2 kinds of vaccines, one that lasts for 3 years, one that lasts for 1 year. And this is, it's all laid out in the next interview. I spoke with Dr. Jim Roth, who's the director of the Center for Food Security and Public Health in the College of Veterinary Medicine at Iowa State.
Rabies vaccination is recommended for dogs and cats. First dose between 3 to 4 months of age, and then a second dose within a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's recommended by the vaccine companies and approved by the USDA. And then after that second dose at a year of age, the boosters are either recommended as annually or every 3 years, depending on the vaccine that's chosen.
I see.
It used to be that it was always vaccinate every year, but then the vaccine companies did the research for some of the vaccines to prove that they will last for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on which vaccine is being used. But generally anymore, veterinarians will use the 3-year vaccine. So then it's once every 3 years.
But suppose one is late with the getting the 3-year vaccine done.
Sure. That's the recommendation based on the testing that's been done.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's rabies, and which is uniformly fatal in animals and people, there's a great deal of caution in interpreting that.
Yes.
So that the second dose, which is to be given within a year of the first dose,
mm-hmm.
as long as you're within that year, your animal is current on their rabies vaccination. If it's longer than a year, then that animal is no longer current on vaccination. And the importance of that is if that animal bites or scratches a person,
sure,
then the public health authorities need to investigate the case, and everyone's obligated to report any animal bites to the public health authorities. Then the public health authorities will investigate if it's deemed to be a dangerous bite, which almost any would be. Then the next question is, is this animal current in their rabies vaccination? And if they're not current, then that animal needs to be quarantined, and it probably will be quarantined for 10 days anyway, but it may be quarantined for a lot longer period of time, and it may even need to be put down. And that
it needs
person,
to be put down because you can't be sure if it's got rabies unless you do put it down or what?
Yes, that's a decision that we made at the time by veterinarian and public health authorities, whether it's a dangerous animal, whether it's likely to have rabies or not.
Mm-hmm.
But then the person that was bitten, if the animal's not current on its rabies shot and it's not certain that the animal's negative, that person will have to undergo post-exposure prophylaxis, a series of very expensive shots. Because nobody wants to make a mistake with rabies because it's uniformly fatal. It's rare in the U.S., but it's uniformly fatal.
From a scientific point of view, though, in your opinion, is it really true that if you're like a few days or a week late with your boosters, that you need to have it every year? Or have I got the wrong end of the stick here?
So if you're late with your booster, you don't have to have it every year. You have to have it. The animal needs to be vaccinated right away if it's past its time on vaccination. And then another booster 1 year later, and then after that every 3 years.
Oh, I see.
Pretty fine.
So, and then that second booster the year later, that would be the one-year kind, would it?
Then that one also needs to be given within 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's over a year, then the animal is not current in its vaccination. And then every 3 years after that, as long as the animal stays current in its vaccination.
I see. So I'm hearing from you that this is a perfectly reasonable regulation.
It is, because it's rabies.
Yes.
Any other of the vaccines your animals get don't have that human health implication.
Right.
So the biology is most likely the immunity continues beyond that 1 year period. But because it's rabies,
and
you
some
don't
animals,
make a mistake.
Some animals, I believe, some individual animals, both cats and dogs, are what they call non-responders?
To many vaccines, yes. So in biology with cats and dogs and people, the majority of the individuals will respond well to a vaccine and be well protected for whatever duration of immunity is on the vaccine label. But there's always variation in biology. So a small percentage of individuals, people or pets, may not be immune after the recommended series of vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we need to vaccinate as many individuals as possible so that there is a high level of immunity in the population and a very low incidence of disease.
Right.
So by everyone getting their vaccinations for themselves and their pets on time, that keeps the incidence of disease very, very low for nearly all diseases. And those individuals that don't respond or that are immunocompromised are then protected by herd immunity, that the majority of the population is immune and not shedding the infectious agent.
Right, right. Why would some animals be immunocompromised?
There's a wide variety of reasons, just like in people.
Mm-hmm.
They can have another infectious disease. They can have undergone surgery. They might be elderly. Might be under a lot of stress. They might have autoimmune diseases. So there is a wide range of reasons why the immune system could be compromised.
Okay. And is it very common for domestic dogs and cats to become infected with rabies, or to be bitten, potentially, in fact, by wild animals that carry rabies?
Yes, it depends on what you mean by common. In Iowa, in the last 10 years, there have been 470 cases of rabies in animals. Most of those are bats and skunks.
Uh-huh.
But there were 48 cats and 16 dogs in Iowa that were rabies positive. And it's, you know, cats especially, many cats are kept indoors all of the time.
Yeah, well,
however, it's not unusual for bats to get in houses.
Right.
And for cats to be exposed to a bat. So in the U.S. annually, the CDC says there's about 1 to 3 human cases of rabies every year in the U.S.
Really?
So it's rare, but uniformly fatal.
Well, once you've been bitten, I mean, you can do something about it, though. I mean,
right.
You say it's fatal, so, but there are things you can do. Although, as you say, it's expensive and very painful, I believe.
If you know you've been exposed, then you need to seek advice from a public health official who will assess the level of exposure. But if there's any doubt, it's highly likely that you'll be recommended to get post-exposure prophylaxis.
Yes, and if you've been bitten by a wild animal, they usually can't find the wild animal to find out whether it had rabies or not.
Right. And even if you've had a bat in your house that you may have been exposed to in the night and you can't find the bat to test it, or the test is inconclusive, they recommend the prophylaxis.
Hmm.
So last year in the U.S., 40,000 people had the rabies post-exposure prophylaxis.
My. Just because they'd had a bat in their house and it might have bitten them when they were asleep and they didn't realize? Is that the deal or what?
Yeah, that's a concern with bats in the house. But also wild animal exposure where you can't find the wild animal. If there's any doubt at all, they'll recommend the post-exposure prophylaxis because it's such a deadly disease.
Sure. Now, as I said at the beginning, I believe, I can't remember who told me this, that this varies from county to county.
Yes. For rabies, there are state laws on getting animals vaccinated for rabies. There can be county laws, and there can be city ordinances. And Ames has a city ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
So the veterinarian will know what the ordinances are in their local region, and you have to follow those ordinances.
But the implication, if there's different ordinances in different areas, the implication is that the science on this matter isn't very clear, isn't it?
Yes. The science is relatively clear, but it's, you know, those 40,000 people that get post-exposure prophylaxis, if the decision is that the vaccine isn't current, then that animal could be rabid. And you don't want to make a mistake. So that's why there are ordinances. And the immunity to anything is variable. You know, there's variation in populations.
Right.
So they really err on the side of being conservative because you don't want to make a mistake.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Roth. I've been talking to Dr. Jim Roth, who's a professor of veterinary medicine at Iowa State. Have you got a more specific title than that, Dr. Roth?
I'm the director of the Center for Food Security and Public Health in the College of Veterinary Medicine.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate this interview.
Yes, thank you.
And now, finally, on this topic, let's hear briefly from the state veterinarian, Dr. Schmidt. This is the person that Dr. Keller, the man with the 8 dogs, refused to speak to himself because he considered that the job of the ombudsman. I began by asking Dr. Schmidt a hypothetical question. I just want to make sure I've got this straight. So, say my dog has had his preliminary shots and he's now due for a booster, a 3-year booster, and I'm a day late. Now what
That's
happens?
Correct. Then the veterinarian can administer the vaccine that is good for a year or 12 months as it's labeled, and if they booster it within the 12 months or 1 year as labeled with a 3-year product, then it's good for 3 years.
Okay, so if I'm late, I take a 1-year booster for the dog, and then after that year's up, then I have another 3-year booster.
If it's done within the 12 months or the labeling requirement.
Right, okay.
Yes.
Okay. I understand this does vary from county to county, though, and I can't understand the logic of that.
It's certainly not in our guidance document. Our department along with the Iowa Department of Public Health, the state public health veterinarian, and the executive director at the Iowa Veterinary Medical Association, produce a rabies resource manual, and so, that information is in there regarding booster vaccination.
So, in other words, if it's varying from county to county, it's mostly because different counties...
The veterinarian has not followed the guidance document.
Ah.
Because the guidance document goes out to veterinarians.
Yeah, okay. So they just don't...
That's a veterinarian. The veterinarian then ended up making a choice as far as on that. But clearly, it's detailed in our rabies resource manual. It's not by the county.
It's just the individual veterinarian making a judgment.
Made a judgment as far as on that. That is outside of the guidance document.
It is just a little bit hard to believe that a dog can be immune one day and not immune the next day. The immunity fades completely in a matter of a few hours.
I don't disagree. But that is not how the product is labeled. The product is labeled according to what the manufacturers, the vaccine companies, submit to USDA Center for Veterinary Biologics, and that's how the product is labeled.
Yeah, so you're basically saying you're just trying to administer the law really in a clean-cut way without getting in too much into without getting into the finer points of this at all.
Correct.
Okay.
What is labeled, what is approved, those are what veterinarians see. This is what owners should look at.
And there you have it. Pet owners should pay attention and get their animals vaccinated in a timely manner. I guess that's what it finally comes down to. Dr. Schmidt did go on to point out that most veterinarians send reminders to pet owners, giving them plenty of time to get their animals vaccinated before the deadline. He was also kind enough to send me a copy of the rabies resource manual that he was talking about. So I hope that helps set some people who are nervous about vaccines, I hope that helps set them a bit straighter on this. Now we're going to have a complete change of topic, Midnight Madness. And we're just getting Roman Lynch on the phone.
Hello.
Oh, hello there. How are you all set for tomorrow's? It's a run, right? Midnight Madness?
Yep. It's a 5K and a 10K.
Sorry, just spell that out for me. What's 5K and 10K?
Yes, 5K and a 10K. And, you know, people can run both of them. We just add their times together.
Okay.
And that would, of course, be a 15K.
What does that mean, 15K?
Kilometers.
Okay.
In the track world or race world or whatever.
Okay.
And they don't use yards anymore. Remember the 100-yard dash?
Yeah, sure.
Meter dash.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. I see. Okay. And this is from 7 till 10 p.m., right?
Right.
So where does midnight come in?
Well, when they first started it, 1972, when Highway 30 was going from Ames to Boone, before it was open, they got up there and they ran a marathon down to Boone and back at midnight.
I see. So that's a historical thing. It's not. It's
yeah.
Not. But you do have a party. You do have a party after the run, right?
Do what?
There's a party after the run.
Yes, absolutely.
Is that a street party or one?
Well, you can make it over the street, but it's in that parking lot just across from City Hall.
Okay. Now, I believe you need an announcer for tomorrow. Have you got that taken care of now?
I do. It was unbelievable. I stopped by there yesterday, and it was just a matter of an hour or so. I got, because I stopped, I thought, well, maybe somebody over there would like to do that. And so we're all square on that end.
So you've got someone now?
Yes.
Okay, good. So that's taken care of. That's good. Okay, so I'm sure everyone that's going to do it knows about it by now, but just one more time, just tell us about this. People might like to show up for the party and they hadn't heard of it before.
Yeah, well, you know, they can registration. Now, here's the thing. The registration starts at 2 tomorrow, and they can still – there's no sign-up today afternoon, but they can sign up tomorrow, and there's a big shoe sale over there if you need some – walking and running shoes, it's unbelievable how discounted they are.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. right. Take care.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm Pat Schlarbaum, one of your hosts for today with Kay Puttick. We are now at the time of year when we think of vacations or weekend getaways, loading up the car and traveling. Mary Rankin, Director of Sustainability for Iowa State University and also Sustainability Coordinator for the city, joins us today and has brought a guest to talk about how Iowa State University considers sustainability in their travels. Hello, and who have you brought with you today, Mary?
Good morning, Pat. It's lovely to see you. Lovely to join you again, Kay.
Thank you.
I am thrilled again to be here with KHOI for our monthly program.
To have you.
Yes, it's always exciting. And today, I'm really thrilled to bring with me Kathy Wellick, who's the Director of Transportation Services at Iowa State University. And Kathy is, I mean, I consider her like the guru of all things that moves and travels. that includes a motor and wheels and that sort of thing. And I'm sure I am not at all giving justice to all the many things that you do, Kathy. But certainly sustainability and transportation, I know we've talked about it. It's very important for the city of Ames. Certainly it's important at Iowa State University as well. And so Kathy and her team do such a phenomenal job of addressing that at Iowa State. Kathy, could you give a better overview of all the responsibilities that you have?
Absolutely. So thanks for having me today. I'm pleased to be able to speak with the listeners about ISU Transportation Services. And when people ask my occupation and I respond that I'm the fleet director at Iowa State, they always say, fleet director? What's fleet?
They think of the Navy or something.
Exactly. And I don't have any ships in the fleet, although I do have a lot of variety in the fleet. Yeah. So ISU Transportation Services fleet consists of approximately 550 vehicles, give or take a few units, depending on our buying and disposal cycle. We have anything from compact cars to panel trucks to emergency vehicles and so forth. And I have the pleasure of leading a staff in all aspects of fleet and fleet sustainability. So for us, no 2 days are the same. The only constant is change, and you got to be flexible. So our department leases vehicles on a daily, seasonal, or yearly basis to other departments for university business only. We have our own on-site fueling stations that are open 24/7. We have unleaded and diesel tanks underground. We have above-ground E85 tanks. So we have those wonderful EPA rules and regulations and inspections and so forth for the fuel site. We actually also have our own on-site shop and car wash. And the department takes sustainability seriously and looks in many ways to reach out for sustainability goals. I also get to work a lot with great staff and peers on the sustainability efforts with the Regents and the Department of Transportation and the Department of Administrative Services to purchase the vehicles. We do our bids together so we can reduce cost with larger big quantities. And when bidding, we always ask for flex fuel vehicles when available. Flex fuel, obviously, is very important in this state.
Now, that means what exactly?
So that means that they can run multiple fuels, mainly E85, or if it's a diesel, B20. And then also regular gasoline or diesel.
Now, you mentioned the on-site fueling stations, but if people are taking students, say, on a trip, I don't know, a long way, they can fill up somewhere else to come back, presumably.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. So they might be up for a 5K or a 10K, but they might not be up for a marathon across the United States.
So. No, I used to remember taking students to art museums and things. It was always a big trauma for me. I always got my graduate students to drive the vehicle. I never drove it. All these little things I had to worry about.
Yeah, it is true. Even the code sometimes that you have to put in mystifies me. So it's not as easy as one would think.
Yeah, exactly. So the student organizations, if they're in good standing, they can still rent the vehicles as long as it's university business. So going to a conference or going to a competition or something like that. Otherwise, it does have to be university business. We do get a lot of community members calling, asking if they can rent our 15-passenger vans, but unfortunately they cannot. It strictly needs to be for the business purposes of the university. We also try really hard to purchase hybrids. We've purchased electric vehicles, and flex fuel vehicles are those are not the only items for sustainability in our area. So we also want to be good stewards of the earth and so forth. So some of our other examples of sustainability are we recycle the paper and cardboard, which is very common. But we also recycle our used oil, recycle the used tires. We've gone completely paperless in our shop. So when the folks are trying to prep the vehicles and so forth, there's no more looking at clipboards and checking things off. Everything is just up on a screen. So we aren't wasting all that paper. We recycle all our old parts and
I noticed you've got your material on a screen, unlike me. I've got mine.
And we also installed a lot of bulk fluid tanks. So we don't have windshield washer 1 gallon containers all over the world. So we buy as much as we can in bulk. And then also a few years ago, we switched out our car wash so we can actually program it with a remote and so forth. So we can use less water on those that were kind to the vehicle and adjust it up for those that hit it heavy in the field, I guess as you would say.
That's really interesting. I know through the Smart Business Challenge, one of our platinum members in the city is the Wildwater Car Wash. And in looking at all the different things just that's done and the car wash, function related to sustainability, it's really fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, it really gives you a whole new concept of, gosh, I don't think I want to wash my car in my driveway because it's so much more wasteful than the great work that the car washes do in recirculating water and managing the water use and all of those pieces.
Yeah, so
it's
absolutely
really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, you must have, Iowa State, you must have a lot of farm vehicles, too.
Absolutely.
Tractors and things like that.
Yes, there are lots of tractors and so forth.
It's not like ordinary farming. It's sort of on an experimental basis. You have to measure everything. So that's all part of it.
Absolutely. You bet. We might have to upfit a pickup to be able to track coyotes. And then the next vehicle is going to be a vet truck that you got to make sure they can do a service call on out in the field for a cow and make sure that everything is there for them. So we do a lot of upfitting of our vehicles as well.
Mm-hmm.
So about of our 550, about 300 are out annually for specific uses in departments that we can outfit.
It's a considerable amount to keep track of, Kathy.
Yes. Computers are wonderful when they
exactly.
work.
Exactly.
With the operative term sustainability, you're really to be complimented for taking on these conservation measures to ensure that people get the most for their bang for their buck
when it
comes to all the vehicles that Iowa State University provides.
Well, and then there's an interesting caveat, too, related to offering staff and faculty the opportunity to not necessarily have to use a vehicle through the rideshare program.
Yes.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Because
that runs all through your office as well.
Absolutely. You bet. So we do have a rideshare or van pool that we offer. Right now we come from 6 different communities where staff can commute to work, to and from work. We have one currently in Story City, one from Roland, one from Ankeny, one from Boone, one from Des Moines, and one from the Waukee area. And we're always looking for ways to expand that as well. And basically what we do there is the employees together share the cost of the vehicle, and we do a set monthly fee. The driver does not pay as kind of an incentive to get them to drive. And the money is taken out pre-tax, and then they're also given 10 free parking passes for the year if they need to drive their personal vehicle onto campus. But this really saves a lot because most of them are 15-passenger vans. So you have 14 less vehicles coming onto campus, 14 less vehicles going down the road every morning, you know, for each van pool that we have. It's very cost effective. All the fuel, insurance, everything is included. While they're at work, we can run over. We have spare keys. We'll do the oil changes and so forth,
oh,
and
wow.
then we'll put it right back in the parking spot that it was in when they come out of work, their vehicle is serviced. So we like it too. We can keep up on the service, and it's a great project. And if anybody would like to start one, I know there has been some interest in the Marshalltown area. We've been trying to get one started there. So if there's anybody listening, please contact me if you would like to start one.
I'm not absolutely clear how this starts. You were talking about these vehicles as if they were they were owned not by Iowa State, but by the individual driver.
Nope, they are owned by Iowa State, but we just take the cost of the vehicle, so the fuel and maintenance, and divide it up amongst the employees.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Of that van.
For okay. the use of the van for the
yeah.
road.
Okay, yeah. I see. Yeah. Now, you must have a lot of vehicles that you have to retire.
Absolutely. They're starting to be older than they used to be when they retire, but I think that's the American way.
I was going to say, I see that all around.
Exactly. So it used to be we kept the vehicles to 75,000 miles. Now we keep them closer to 100,000 miles. That can be anywhere from 3 years if it's a car to 10 years if it's a pickup. And we're trying a lot harder to rotate the vehicles around. So if we have one that's on campus, the majority of those years that aren't getting very many miles, switching that out sooner and put it on the road to get some miles on that before we dispose of it. But we are so fortunate here when we dispose our vehicles because we have a wonderful partnership with the Department of Transportation Services here in Ames. And we sell our vehicles through their auction. It's a well-known auction where a lot of dealers and a lot of community members come to find a vehicle for that college student that's going to college. They know that the vehicles are very well maintained. They can come to us and get the records and so forth. But the DOT is close, and we do an auction every end of May or beginning of June and then October. So that's the times of year that you want to look or give us a jingle if you're looking for a vehicle, and we can let you know what we're selling.
So I'm interested, Kathy, when you look at purchasing vehicles. Could you tell us more about that process and how you look at having the diversity within the fleet that you need, as well as touching on some of those areas of sustainability that you mentioned?
Absolutely. So with the bid process, again, we do partner with DOT and DAS and the other regions. And with the other regions, I'm for those that who might not know what the regions consist of, it is University of Iowa, Iowa State, and University of Northern Iowa. And then we also have the two special schools, the School for the Deaf and the Iowa Braille Sight Saving School. And I'm also in charge of assisting them with their vehicles, the two special schools. So when we start the spec process, we're actually starting that right now for the vehicles that we'll get next spring. This week we met with the vehicle manufacturers, and we like open and fair competition. So we will go through the fleet, see what's going to be hitting on the mileage in years as to what needs replaced, speak with the customers to find out, is this the same type of vehicle that they need, or can they get by with a smaller vehicle, and so forth. And then we present what we feel we're going to need to all the manufacturers, and they look over the specs and see if there's anything that blocks their particular brand from being bid, because we want to be able to have competition in the bidding process. And so that's kind of their time to offer suggestions and so forth. And then we go out to bid, and when the bids come back in approximately October, we life cycle cost them. State code requires that we life cycle cost. And so what's built into that is the price of the vehicles, the resale value in 5 years, and then also the fuel economy. Mm-hmm. Obviously, fuel economy is a big thing these days. And I think one of the most interesting topics that we've had this week with the manufacturers is being able to get a spare tire. That's not something you can usually actually get anymore.
That's amazing. Wow. Yeah. It's so true. You mentioned that, but gosh.
So all these new EPA guidelines and miles per gallons that they have to hit and so forth, a lot of that has to do with the weight of the vehicle. And for them to put a spare tire in a vehicle adds weight and will decrease their fuel economy.
Is that why they make spare tires smaller now?
A lot of them, it's just a fix-a-flat. It's a can of fix-a-flat.
Oh.
You aren't even going to have a tire at all.
Oh.
So if you're having a Malibu right now, you won't. You're just going to get a can.
That is so interesting.
I know. Exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
Exactly. So those kind of things change. So after we life cycle cost those out, we see what's the best overall at the end of the life cycle of the vehicle. We always bid with state code, too. We always have to bid E85 or flex fuel engines. If the midsize car is available in a flex fuel, that will win over a non-flex fuel vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So I understand also Iowa State University Transportation Services has just been honored. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of your honors quickly.
Well, thank you. Yes, we have a great team. We're very fortunate. We're a small team, but we work very well together. And we did just become an accredited sustainable fleet with NAFA, which is the National Association of Fleet Administration. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the leader mm-hmm. in the fleet world. And so that's pretty exciting. We also, this last year in April, we got in the top 100 fleets for North America. And we also got number 18 in the sustainability fleets.
Well,
the
congratulations.
Top
that's so exciting, Kathy.
Yeah.
That is. Yeah.
We're trying to do things right.
Mm-hmm. So this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been visiting with Kathy Wellick. With the Iowa State Transportation System, Mary Rankin. And thank you so much for that. I'm one of your hosts for today. So earlier we heard from Dwayne Schrunk that provided professional due diligence in determining the cause of an afflicted Iowa eaglet. Dr. Keller of Roland, Iowa, and from ISU veterinary Dr. Jim Roth and state veterinarian Dr. Schmidt. We also heard from Roman Lynch about tomorrow's Midnight Madness.
Our theme music is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. You could be here doing what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org, or just drop by the studio at 410 Douglas in downtown Ames. We are always welcome. If you enjoyed this show, please tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. You can also listen to this show and all our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. You'll find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it. Thank you, Ron.
And KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org, where you can also find archives of KHOI's other shows. And now stay tuned for Morning Masterpieces. And please remember that you, as listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio. Thank you.